enable you to be able to have those conversations and have your loved ones around you when you do die.
You're amazing. Thank you. And thanks to everybody this morning. And to Val Stango and Dr. Laura Chapman.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Adam Porter. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed calls for a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon. His office said the proposal was an idea put forward by America and France, which he hadn't responded to. He added that he'd ordered the army to continue the fighting with full force. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bachega, who's in Beirut, says it's unlikely Hezbollah would accept a ceasefire either.
Here in Lebanon, Hezbollah has remained defiant. The group says these attacks on Israel are going to continue, that this is, in solidarity with the Palestinian population of Gaza, and that the attacks are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So it's very difficult to see how they're going to agree with the deal without a ceasefire in Gaza.
Elon Musk has given a scathing response on X after the BBC revealed he hadn't been invited to the government's International Investment Summit next month. Mr. Musk said he didn't think anyone should go to the UK when they were releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts. He didn't cite any evidence for his claim. Sources say he wasn't invited because of his social media posts during the recent riots. The BBC has heard harrowing testimony from a woman who said she was raped by the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed, when she was 16, after being made to have intrusive medical examinations. The woman said they were arranged for her with Dr. Anne Coxon, who hasn't replied to the BBC's request for comment. Harrods' new owners have previously apologised unreservedly for the actions of Mohammed Al-Fayed. Mike Radford is the executive producer of the BBC documentary, which aired the claims against the former tycoon.
This is the first time she's spoken openly, and we can report what she said. We've been in contact with her for a number of months during the making of the documentary. But like many survivors, speaking publicly is, as you can imagine, a huge step. These are the most traumatic experiences for them, whose consequences reverberate for decades afterwards. And as a result, many are understandably reticent.
An 18-year-old is due to appear in court this morning, charged with the murder of a 15-year-old boy in Woolwich in southeast London. Jacob Loshevich is accused of killing Dejuan Campbell, who was found stabbed on Sunday. The world's longest-serving death row inmate has been acquitted by a Japanese court after it found that evidence used against him was fabricated. Iwu Hakamada, who's 88, had been on death row for over 50 years. He was found guilty in 1968 of killing his boss, the man's wife, and their two teenage children. Our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil says the case has led to questions about the Japanese justice system.
There's been huge questions about his treatment, about how long he was kept in solitary confinement for. And I think a bigger picture, remember, is that only Japan and the United States are the two G7 countries that are still that still adopt the capital punishment. So this has ended, but a lot of questions about his treatment and the treatment of the evidence over the years.
BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 11.
And here are your latest sports headlines on 5 Live. Manchester United boss Erik Ten Hag says he'll have to look in the mirror after a disappointing 1-1 draw with his former club, Twente, in the Europa League. He said they had to put the game to bed. They didn't. The action, though, continues tonight. Spurs host Karabag and Rangers go to Malmo, while it is crunch time for Arsenal women in Champions League qualifying. They're 1-0 down to Hecken going into their second leg at home tonight, so they have to win that to get into the tournament proper. We'll have reporters at all the key games for you in 5 Live Sport from 7. Elsewhere, West Ham boss Julen Lopetegui has apologised to the fans after they were thrashed 5-1 by Liverpool in the League Cup. The manager also picked up an injury at Anfield after stamping on the touchline in frustration. And Britain's Jack Draper is through to the Japan Open last 16 following a straight sets win over Mattia Bellucci. It's his first victory since losing in the US Open semi-finals earlier this month, and then a disappointing showing for Britain in the Davis Cup.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's
got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Adrian Childs.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
It's 11:05. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Be with you until 2 o'clock. We'll keep a close eye on what's happening in the Middle East. There's this talk of a ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel this morning, which we thought had been agreed, and then it quickly turned out it wasn't, played down by the Israeli leadership. More on that in a moment. In our winner's enclosure today, we have got John Aldridge, a Liverpool legend, League and FA Cup winner. He'll be here after 11:30. Really looking forward to speaking to him. Looking forward to being with Martin Lewis as well between 1 and 2. We'll be talking about mortgages today. There have been cheaper rates about in recent weeks. Have you benefited from this? Do you want some guidance on it? And his tell us today is about your first ever pay packet. He wants to know, what did you do with your first pay packet? Did you save or splurge? Mine was for a paper round, and it was 7 days hard labour for all of £3.20. And I honestly can't tell you how I spent all that money. I'll rack my brains. It might have been for a record I couldn't afford. And also, we got the 3,500-year-old cheese. It was made in Western China. Fragments have been found. What does this tell us about cheese making? What does it? What are the scientific discoveries that this is going to lead us to? This 3,500-year-old cheese. Do get in touch. Text us on 85058, or you can call or WhatsApp on 08085 909 693. Actually, my producer's just had a good idea. I mean, that 3,500-year-old cheese is obviously past its sell-by date. But I just wonder what's the oldest sell-by date you've got in your fridge at the moment? What's the oldest thing you've got in there? I found something that expired in May 21 last night, but it wasn't in the fridge. Anyway, it's in the bin now. You'll be relieved to know. It's just gone 7 minutes past 11. Let's start with the continuing strife in the Middle East. In the past hour, the Israeli Foreign Minister, Israel Katz, has said there will be no ceasefire in the north and his country will continue to fight against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The statement came hours after the US, UK and others at the UN General Assembly in New York called for a 21-day ceasefire. Overnight, the Israeli military says it hit around 75 Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon and the Bekaa region. Our correspondent in Beirut, as you've been hearing from her all week, is Lina Sinjab. Lina, what is the latest situation where you are?
Well, it's the worry and the fear is still continuing in Lebanon, especially after the statements coming from the Israeli government that there is no room for ceasefire. People were holding some hopes that a deal or some talks are going on for, you know, stopping the hostilities, but it seems it's not happening. You know, airstrikes continued overnight. We still hear some Hezbollah also airstrikes took place. You know, missiles, rockets were fired into northern Israel. But the damage that's happening at this end of the conflict is way worse, and people are still in panic mode. We're actually seeing lots of people packing and leaving the whole country, not only trying to relocate and come to safe areas of the country as they feel that, you know, the instability is going to continue and will expand. And you know, there is nowhere where for them to be reassured of an end for this conflict.
I mean, I don't know whether these calls for a 21-day ceasefire, whether those filtered through
to you in Beirut and elsewhere, to the people there, but would there have been any hope of that ceasefire being agreed to?
Well, that's what people were hoping for, especially that there are some information circulating in local media here that the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birley, has been involved in talks, and he said that there was a statement coming from him that saying the coming 24 hours are very decisive whether these talks are going to be fruitful or not. But then this morning, people woke up to statements coming from the Israeli side saying there is no room for ceasefire, they're continuing attacking Hezbollah, and even they're preparing for ground operation, and that's all sending, you know, waves of panic and worries across Lebanon.
And we're getting reports as well that the Hezbollah rockets might have gone as far as the Red Sea resort of Eilat in Israel. Is there any? Have you got anything on that?
Well, there were some reports suggesting that there were two drones attacks coming from Iraq, actually, not from Lebanon, that targeted the Eilat port or resorts in the Red Sea. But there hasn't been any further information. There were little damage there, so it wasn't a huge one, but certainly didn't come from Lebanon, this one.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. From Beirut, that's Lena Sinjab. We're joined now by Alistair Burt, who you'll remember was Minister of State for the Middle East at the Foreign Office between 2017 and 2019. Excuse me. So thanks for coming on. What is your take on the current situation?
Thank you for asking, Adrian. I think my take is that this is as serious as it's ever been. I don't think anyone should underestimate the determination of Israel to remove the threat that they have had from their northern border for many years. They've now evacuated their population from northern Israel. This is seen by people in Israel as a defeat for Israel and a victory for Hezbollah. And there is a great determination to reverse that by stopping the rockets. I think diplomats can only do what they're doing, which is to plead for a ceasefire. But then the issues that have led to the increase in confrontation recently have got to be dealt with. They haven't been dealt with over the years. And that's led to the fear of people in southern Lebanon and northern Israel. But I think the determination of Israel to end the threat or to try and end the threat of Hezbollah is very real and may well lead to the next step of a ground incursion to try and make that happen.
Is it possible to end that threat, or will it just come up in another form? You couldn't imagine anyone feeling safe in northern Israel for the foreseeable future.
That's quite right, Adrian. History would tell you that there hasn't been a military solution to this. Israel has been in Lebanon in the past, in the 1980s, as recently as 2006, to push back Hezbollah. And all that happens is there is then a pause for a period of time. Hezbollah rearms itself and makes itself a threat again. And the issues that are between Hezbollah and Israel and issues affecting the Palestinian question in the region are not dealt with. So sooner or later, the problem comes back again. It won't be resolved militarily. No one can win a conclusive war in that region. It will be a catastrophe. That's why the determination must be to try and get talks going. But this is very, very difficult to do because the parties involved want talks and peace less than the outside community.
The foreign affairs analyst and writer Tim Marshall joins us. On the current situation, is anything you add to what Alistair Burt said to us, Tim?
Well, Mr. Burt's been in the thick of it in diplomacy. I was actually in Beirut in 2006 during the previous encounter between the two, and I would agree it's worse this time because if it happens, if it's all-out war, I think it'll be worse than 2006. And the reason for that is that then Israel made it clear, as far as it was concerned, this was Israel versus Hezbollah. Subsequent to that, Hezbollah has joined the government. When it did, Israel said, if this happens again, as you're a part of the government, we will consider the whole of Lebanon that we are against. And therefore, I think that the range of targets and the infrastructure of the country, I think, will be more heavily damaged than last time. So I still think diplomacy has a chance, because although the Israeli Prime Minister's office has said they're not going to abide by this French, American, British, Saudi, you name it, people have signed up to it, idea of a 21-day ceasefire, I haven't heard it from Netanyahu himself yet. He's going to be on his way. He's either gone or he's on his way to New York for the United Nations General Assembly, and at which point he will meet a firestorm of diplomacy. So, you know, it's not dead yet, but it's not looking good.
I mean, having walked those corridors, Alistair, in the United Nations, what do you suppose will greet the Israeli leader when he gets there? And does any meeting matter other than the one that he has with leading Americans and hopefully Joe Biden?
Meetings that matter will certainly involve Arab states that have worked to, normalize, relations with Israel, the Saudis, the Emiratis. Those will be important meetings. The meetings with the US are by far the most important, but other European leaders will be consulted. But the hostility that Tim speaks of is very, very real. The antipathy towards Israel amongst many nations is huge and has grown since the response of Israel to the atrocity of October the 7th. And it's very, very deep throughout the United Nations General Assembly. It's hard to pinpoint precisely why, but the failure to resolve the issues affecting the Palestinian people, which we have seen over many years, that is now fundamentally at the heart of it. It had dropped down the agenda. Everybody knows this from about 2014 onwards, when John Kerry's latest efforts on peace concluded. And since then, it has been off the agenda for so many states, including those in the region, as well as others, but very much there back now.
And Tim, later we'll hear from Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I just wonder whether we can have any hope that he's going to be anything but ultra-defensive with his back against the wall, having been sort of yelled at by representatives of all nations at the UN. Yeah, when he comes to make his speech, what are you listening for when he speaks?
I'm listening for a sentence that says they're open to a negotiation. I'm trying to frame what I think is happening, because I said to you right about this time last week that we weren't closer to an all-out war after the pages, because prior to the pages going off, Hezbollah's command and control system was still intact. And there were two choices. Hezbollah could choose and has the ability to go into Israel. Israel, obviously, we know, has the ability to go into Lebanon and may still do it. But when, after the pages went off and after the walkie-talkies went off and then the subsequent bombing campaign, Hezbollah is in no position to go into Israel now. They are absolutely on the back foot. So what the Israelis have done is this awful phrase, they've escalated to de-escalate. This is a Russian nuclear doctrine where if you are invaded in a conventional manner, you respond with a tactical battlefield nuclear weapon, you escalate, and then you say, right, let's talk, to de-escalate. And I think that's what the Israelis are doing, but they're going to do it on their terms. And if they don't get a pretty quick response from Hezbollah, and do note the rate of missiles from Hezbollah into Israel over the past 24 hours is seriously down. If, when they get to New York and gets fire breathed on him, they can just say, okay, we'll give this a chance. But if they don't get something really quite open from Hezbollah that, all right, we are going to stand down, then I'm not sure what there is left to stop the ground invasion.
So, Alistair, we had a text in from somebody called Mary asking a really legitimate question, is what's happening in Gaza now? It's all quiet. I assume the one thing it isn't is quiet. Is it just that, you know, us in the media have just, we've moved on to a newer story as we want to do?
No, it is genuinely, quiet is a terrible phrase, bearing in mind the degree of destruction in Gaza. My understanding is there's one battalion of the IDF operating in Gaza, which is fewer than there was in the past because the bulk of its activity has come to an end. Still pursuing the release of the hostages, presumably still pursuing Yahya Sinwar as well. But the fact that the activity in Gaza has lessened has released members of the Israeli forces to think about Lebanon. Lebanon has always been on the horizon for Israel. They have always wanted to counter the threat. And there's many who've been advocating in the cabinet for a long time that this had to be taken on. But they couldn't fight on two fronts. Perhaps that was the view of the army command. But now there's less activity in Gaza, then they can turn their attention to the north. And at Tim's point may be right. Maybe because of the threat now of possible incursion and the like, if anything would concentrate minds, perhaps that is. But, you know, one wonders why minds haven't been concentrated for so long with the degree of atrocity all round. No good can come of the conflicts. Nobody is winning. The victims are still the same, the poor, the defenseless, and those who have been driven out of both Gaza and of northern Israel. The victims are all the same. They're looking to their leaders for something different. And I think that's what the international community have got to try and assist.
Well, except Israel, you know, I think the leadership would say to themselves, we are winning here. You know, we've made massive inroads into Hamas. You know, we've done a hell of a lot of damage to Hezbollah, and that, you know, okay, you can say we've escalated to de-escalate, but also winning becomes intoxicated, and you just think, well, let's keep going. The whole world hates us, but they're going to hate us anyway, and they've let us get away with it so far, so let's crack on.
I take the point, yep. But the counter argument is Hamas has been immensely successful in raising the issue of Palestine amongst the world community. Israel's international reputation has been immensely damaged by their actions in Gaza. They've lost, it would appear, some of the support they had of Gulf states. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia have said there's no progress to be made with their relationship with Israel unless there is self-determination for the Palestinian people. Lebanon is seen by the Israelis as a success. And absolutely, people in Israel want to feel safe from Hamas, and they have supported the action that has been taken. But there has been an international reaction. Ultimately, for Israel, that is not the most important thing to them. But the security and the safety of the people of Israel has not been guaranteed by Israelis' policy over so long. So there has to be something different, and that needs better leadership amongst the Palestinians as well as Arab states. But nobody is really winning in this confrontation.
Tim, you were going to say something.
Well, yeah, I was struck by your phrase about the intoxication of victory. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, contrary to some analysis, they have been successful at incredible cost in Gaza, because they have taken apart most of Hamas, and they're now in the process of taking apart large sections of Hezbollah. And after 2006, they bought themselves 18 years of more or less quiet on that northern frontier, and they intend to buy themselves another X amount of years, one way or another, either by Hezbollah standing down or by them smashing half of Lebanon. And Lebanon, the Lebanese are very, very frightened at the moment, because it's not just the Israelis that if they go to war, the Lebanese armed forces may have to get involved as well. And they would probably splinter and go back to the different militia factions that are represented. And you know, the destruction in Lebanon could even spark another civil war there, because people would certainly blame Hezbollah as well as Israel for what has happened, which is, you know, this is why it is so much on a knife edge. I still don't think it has to be a much wider war involving the whole of the Middle East. The Syrians will stand by and watch. The Gulf states will stand by and watch. Iran really doesn't want to get involved. No one's going to, I don't think there's any cavalry coming to the rescue of either Hamas or Hezbollah. But the stakes for Lebanon really couldn't be higher.
Alistair, do you see any hope for Lebanon? Are they right to be worried in the sort of apocalyptic terms that Tim suggests it might be?
Lebanon's recent history would bear testimony to his outlook as being pretty correct. They had to rebuild Lebanon after the civil war. They had to rebuild after 2006. Lebanon is always a victim. It's riven by the sectarian disputes. It's barely functioning as a state at present. They're right to be, they're right to be frightened. And for all the years of peace that was bought after 2006, well, it's only years of peace until you get another, confrontation. There is an extra cost to Israel, of course. They're beginning to lose people who are beginning to emigrate, and families who do not want their youngsters brought up in a situation where they're likely to have to fight at some stage in their future. That is a cost to Israel that is increasing as well. So all these human costs, when you add it up, what is the point of conflict? There must be a better way to resolve the issues between people and give people peace and security that they deserve.
I mean, it's somehow depressing that, you know, in the world's greatest democracy, supposedly, that the electoral cycle there in America is so significant here. I mean, how would things be different if I don't know, Trump was in charge now, or there was a Democratic president in charge now, Tim?
I'm not sure it makes that much difference on this one. I mean, briefly switching to Ukraine, I think that normally on major foreign policy issues and major global strategy, it doesn't actually matter who the American president is. You know, that old adage, America has interests and it has politicians and the politicians come and go, but the interests remain, is true. But on Ukraine, this is a big one, because I do think if Trump comes in, he will pull the support from Ukraine. But on this issue, Israel and the Middle East, no, I don't think it matters which.
But isn't Biden somewhat more tentative, would you say, Alistair, at this than he might otherwise be if we weren't facing the presidential election in a couple of months?
I'm sorry, was that...
Alistair, yeah, for you. Do you think Biden would be behaving any differently now? Is there anything more he could do that he isn't doing, you know, for fear of... For fear of just raising this issue and giving Trump something to go at, you know, ahead of the election?
He will be extremely cautious of his actions. The concern about the Jewish community and their vote in the States is well known, but he also has an American electorate now that are very important in some of the swing states. So he will be proceeding with great caution, trying to make sure there is not a decision taken which further polarizes the issue or leads to some sort of catastrophe. So it will be conditioning his actions to some extent.
I suppose that's what Adrian, I was trying to get at, Tim. Just
yeah, sorry, Adrian. No, yeah. I completely agree with that. I stand by my previous answer. In general terms, I don't think it matters if it's Trump or Biden. But if you're talking about the electoral cycle, yes, absolutely. I mean, Alistair's referring, I assume, amongst other areas, to Dearborn in Michigan, one of the swing states, which has a very large Muslim community in it. And this is one of the issues that can swing votes one way or the other. So, yeah, both candidates are very aware of this and are treading very cautiously. But Biden, the administration will be having sharp words with Netanyahu once he shows up there. I think we've got a few days to play with before a potential incursion. I think the word from Netanyahu's office is a little disingenuous, and in its wording, they're talking about the French, American, this, that, and the other initiative. They're not completely ruling out diplomacy. If they can just get this statement out of Hezbollah about standing down, this is still salvageable. I always remember what happened after 2006. Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, the 2006 war was sparked when Hezbollah went across the border in a guerrilla raid and kidnapped two Israeli soldiers. That's what's brought the Israelis in. He said afterwards, if I'd have known that operation would result in such damage, I wouldn't have ordered that operation. So I'm hoping he's keeping that in mind and searching for a form of words that allows them to stand down. The words would include 1701, the UN resolution, which says that Hezbollah forces have to be behind the Litani River. If they could work on that, start pulling back behind the Litani, this can still be saved.
Okay, thank you very much to Marshall and also Alistair Burt. Appreciate your time in coming on.
In other news, just before we go to our news and sports bulletin, the world is getting another moon. I don't really understand how the first moon actually operates, but let's move on to this second moon. Dr. Sheila Kanani is an astronomer and planetary scientist. Dr. Kanani, thanks for coming on. So this second moon then, where's this one popped up from?
Well, there's an asteroid belt quite near to Earth, and the gravitational pull of the Earth can sometimes attract things from this asteroid belt, and that's what's happened here with this asteroid.
Right. So, why would it detach?
It doesn't sort of detach as such, but if it's travelling slow enough, and if it gets close enough to Earth, the gravitational pull of the Earth can sort of attract it into the Earth's orbit for a short period of time, which has happened. It's not even going to orbit around the Earth fully in one complete revolution in its time visiting us, but in those sort of 3 months that it's orbiting around the Earth, I suppose you could call it a mini-moon.
OK, but it won't do a full circuit or whatever
No, it won't stay with us long enough before it sort of wanders back to the asteroid belt that it came from.
OK, well, it's nice of it to drop in and say hello, yeah. I suppose. So where will it be in relation to our proper moon?
It'll be moving a few thousand kilometres per hour, and it's about a couple of million miles away from the Earth, and the moon is still significantly different to that. So, there's no sort of viewing opportunity, unfortunately, especially not for amateur astronomers.
Okay, but if you knew what you were doing with it, I mean, you'll be able to have a good, long, loving look at it, I assume.
Well, I don't have access to a big telescope at the moment, but yeah, professional astronomers with observatories and things should be able to image it quite nicely, yeah.
And how rare is this occurrence? And, I mean, can we be quite clear it's not going to sort of misbehave and, you know, collide with us?
Yeah, I mean, so there are scientists that are looking at these objects all the time, potentially hazardous objects and near-Earth objects and things like that. And we can use mathematics and computer modelling to make sure that they're not going to crash into us. And we are quite aware of what's going on out there, but there is a lot of stuff out there. And this one was spotted in August. And is likely to come back in a few in the 2050s. We have been visited by other similar objects, sort of as close as the late 1980s, and then in the 2000s as well. So we do get objects coming into our near Earth vicinity on occasion. But yeah, we do check that they're not going to smash into us either.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much indeed for coming on, Dr. Sheila Kanani, astronomer and planetary scientist. It's just gone 11:30. Let's get the news and sport.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed calls for a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon. His office says the proposal was an idea put forward by America and France, which he hasn't responded to. He added that he's ordered the army to continue fighting with full force. The managing director of Harrods says the company failed our colleagues, and for that we are deeply sorry, following allegations of sexual abuse against former owner Mohammed Al-Fayed. Michael Ward said in a statement that he wanted to convey his personal horror at the revelations that have emerged over the past week. He also wants to make it clear that he was not aware of Fayed's alleged criminality and abuse. An 18-year-old is due to appear in court this morning, charged with the murder of a 15-year-old boy in Woolwich in southeast London. Jacob Lashevich is accused of killing Dejon Campbell, who was found stabbed on Sunday. Elon Musk has given a scathing response on X after the BBC revealed he hadn't been invited to the government's International Investment Summit next month due to previous social media posts. Mr. Musk wrote he didn't think anyone should go to the UK when they were releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts. He didn't cite any evidence for his claim. Katie Smith is here with your sport.
Thank you. Former Liverpool striker Natasha Dowie's told 5 Live this morning she expected a lot more from West Ham under new boss
boss Julen Lopetegui. They were thrashed 5-1 by Liverpool last night as they exited the League Cup in the third round. Lopetegui apologised to fans afterwards. It follows a heavy Premier League loss to Chelsea at the weekend. But of course, a great night for Liverpool, and it continues the new reign under new boss Arne Slot, who says that questions around his club's transfer policy this summer, when they only brought in two senior players, can finally be put to rest.
The funny thing is, in the first 2 months I was here, I constantly had to tell this to everyone, because everybody was only asking me about new signings. And I said, we have already a lot of good players. And now, when the market is closed, everybody is telling me that we have so many good players. So maybe next time I should be more clear in the first 2 months, or you should listen a bit better.
So the League Cup holders Liverpool take on Brighton next. Tottenham face Azerbaijani champions Karabag in the first of their eight group stage games in the new Europa League format. That is this evening. And Spurs boss Ange Postecoglou believes the changes will make the tournament more competitive going forwards.
Yeah, just a gut feeling that there's probably going to be more in games. Usually in the group stage, after about the second, probably the third game, you kind of knew who was going through, so there may be some dead rubbers in there. But I think all games will be meaningful, because all teams will have something to play for, and it's not that sort of standard home and away, so you're going to play, you know, eight different teams, eight different styles of football. So, look, it's an interesting challenge.
Now, I mentioned Brighton. Boss Fabian Hertzler has confirmed this morning that they'll be without star striker João Pedro for the trip to Chelsea. That is this Saturday in the Premier League. But the manager will be allowed in the dugout, he says, after receiving a red card last weekend. That was in the bad-tempered end to their draw with Nottingham Forest. Now, there's a big night ahead too for three British clubs in the final round of Women's Champions League qualifying. Arsenal face Swedish side Häcken at Meadow Park, and they're 1-0 down from the first leg. Gunners keeper Manuela Zinsberger says, though, last season's failure to make the tournament proper isn't what will spur on her side today.
Champions League should be motivation enough, no matter what happened last season. I'm not a fan of talking about the past. I'm more a fan of looking forward, and our motivation is as high as it was last season. I would say even higher, so that's why our expectation that it's like the group stages or even further.
Elsewhere, Manchester City are 5-0 up heading into their second leg with Paris FC. And there's a huge night too for Scottish champion Celtic. They're hoping to reach the group stage for the first time and hold a current 1-0 lead over Ukrainian champions Force Club Poltava from the first leg. And play is underway in nine fixtures in the final round of this year's Cricket County Championship season, with seven others delayed due to bad weather. Warwickshire, Lancashire and Notts all battling to avoid relegation from Division 1, while Yorkshire and Middlesex are both hoping for promotion from Division 2. So you can head to the BBC Sport website and app to listen across. And that is your latest from BBC Sport. If you'd like to hear more, you just need to say to your smart speaker, play BBC Sports News.
Football on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen to exclusive live commentaries from the Premier League, Champions League and more with the 5 Live Sport team.
He's been on the pitch for 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Stay on top of everything football every day with the Football Daily Podcast.
This is the best central defensive partnership in European football.
His confidence levels are through the roof.
Football on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Adrian Childs.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just gone 25 to 12. Coming up after one this afternoon, Martin Lewis will be with me for an hour. Fixed rate mortgage deals have been getting cheaper in recent weeks. Martin will be answering your questions alongside Andrew Montlake, mortgage broker. And he's Tell Us Today. Martin's is your first pay packet. We want to know, what did you do with your first pay packet? Did you save or did you splurge? Was there enough in that pay packet to have a splurge with, I wonder? Let us know. Text 85058, or you can send a WhatsApp or a voice note to 0885 909 693. Now, though, it's time for the winner's enclosure, into which we invite the kind of people who make stuff like this happen.
Listen to the roar! He's going to do it again! Pure magic! Oh!
There's an obstruction
to take!
And today we speak to somebody who's got a Football League second division title under his belt, third division title, a League Cup win with Oxford United, and a league title with Liverpool, and an FA Cup, and a fine run in the Italian World Cup with Ireland. John Aldridge, it's great to have you on. How are you doing?
Hi, Adrian. Doing very well. Thanks, mate. Yeah.
Good, good. So the question I always begin by asking is when you first felt like a winner? When did you first get a taste for it? Was it as a kid? Was it, you know, not till you got to Liverpool or whatever? When did you feel like a winner?
You know, it was me in my primary school. It was Banks Road Comprehensive in Garston, Liverpool. And we actually won the champions of Liverpool when I was aged 10 and 11. We had a great season. We were unbeaten. I scored 50-odd goals. And we won the our side of Liverpool schools, and we played St. Teresa's in the final, and we won 1-0, and I got the goal, and that really was special at the time. You know, really getting the medal. There was only those little plastic medals with a little penny piece in the middle, you know what I mean? Them type, but it meant the world to me.
Yeah. I mean, St. Teresa's, they were a tough opponent. Mm. They sound tough, old St. Teresa's. I mean, can you remember the game when you shut your eyes now?
Vaguely, yeah. I remember getting the medal more than anything. That makes sense. The game was very vague. It was only probably another little 6-yard tap and a score. It was big in them days, you know.
And you were nine years old then or something? 8, 9?
I was all 10, Adrian, yeah. But actually, you know, worse, the older you get, that gives you the zest to go on and do it again and again. The more you win, the more you want to win, basically.
And was there any doubt in your mind you'd go on and keep winning and maybe be a professional footballer one day, or definitely be a professional footballer one day?
That was always my goal. From the first time I went to watch Liverpool in the mid-60s, I made my mind up that I wanted to play for Liverpool, and I wanted to be Roger Runs, who was a massive hero of mine. Number 8 on my back, not number 9. You know, from that day onwards, I said to myself, go for it. You know, try and, you know, I didn't know I was good at that time. I know I could score goals. That was my main ambition in life, to play for Liverpool.
I mean, at that time, you had Liverpool and Everton scouts crawling all over schoolboy and youth football on Merseyside. Mm. But as far as I can see, they didn't pick you up, did they?
No. To be quite honest, I went trialing for Liverpool, and I thought I'd done very well. Tom Saunders was the head of the development, it was called in them days. And he did point to me and he said, I scored a good goal against the B team that day, and he'd definitely give me a ring. And unfortunately, that the phone call came 13 years later, and it cost Liverpool nearly £1 million. I was custard pied. But what I did do, I loved me cricket. I got into Liverpool cricket schoolboy side, which I played a handful of games for them. But then my dad told me to stick to football. I went to Hartlepool. Was a toolmaker by trade, you know, playing non-league football for South Liverpool, and then I got picked up, and you know, the rest is history.
But you know, Newport kind of must have felt like a long way from Liverpool. How did you settle in there? And what age are you at now when you went there?
Well, I just passed my degrees to be a toolmaker by trade, making, you know, cars like the Dolomite Spin, TR7, Triumph Stag. My dad said, I've got to get that pass because Newport only offered me a 1-year contract on less money than I was on in British Leyland. But I took it. I took the chance because I thought it might pass me by. Len Ashurst gave me the opportunity. It was different leaving home for the first time, you know, when you're just only 20. I found it a little bit hard to settle in for a couple of weeks, but then I got to get grips with it. You know, you're talking in them days, and the train's 4 hours to Newport.
It's still 4 hours to Newport from Liverpool. Trust me, I've done that. Train times haven't improved at all.
It's about 6 hours now with the M6 and M5, as you know.
So I just wonder if, to some extent, you might have been better off it happening like this? You were presumably soon became a bigger cog in a smaller wheel than you would have been at Liverpool. So you had a chance to shine at Newport.
Yeah, spot on, absolutely. I say that with you know, I'm lucky to know some Liverpool greats who I idolise, and even my mates now, they were thrown in at the deep end at Liverpool. You know, as an apprentice, and fighting to get in the team against the likes of Kevin Keegan's and Toshak's and all these, Tom Owens and all these great players. Whilst, you know, mine was a gradual incline, which is in life, as we know, that's the best way to go. You know, Newport, we won the Welsh Cup. We got the quarter final of the European Cup, Punch Cup, to be fair. And then got promotion from Division 4. I went to Oxford, we won Division 3, then we won Division 2 and Liverpool Division 1. So in an ideal world, that's what you really want, rather than to get thrown in a deep end.
And what were you learning about the game? Because I think strikers, I think more than any other position, although I'm sure that's nonsense, you know, you can pick things up, you know, when to run, how to run, you know, just where to stand, you know, and so on. Were you learning all the time?
Yeah, well, you never stop learning. I remember reading, you know, I adored Roger and then Kevin Keegan, and I was reading things about Kevin and said, you're never too old to learn, and, you know, and he's spot on. We're all there, even now when we're very old. And like, but I when I went to Newport, for instance, when Tom Saunders said I wasn't good enough, I used that as a motivational weapon to prove him wrong. So when I went to Newport, see, after training, the lads would be in the bath and go to the cafe or whatever. I would not be in the gym or on the field practicing with the apprentice, me head and me touch. And I got myself some spikes, some running spikes. We had to see the track, so I'd be going around the Summerton Park. So I'd work on my short sprints and I'd work on my game, you know, constantly. Because of what I read about other players. So you know, when you get an opportunity, you don't sit back. You don't wait for it to happen. You make it happen.
And who on the coaching staff, so maybe the other players you were with, who were you learning from? Is anyone that sticks in your mind at Newport or with Jim Smith, was a famously great coach at Oxford United? What were they teaching you?
Jim, I was lucky to have great managers. Len Ashurst was a hard taskmaster in them days. You know, he was really tough on you, which is a good thing at times. You know, you got to know your players this day and age. You can, you know, go hard at who you've got to put your arm around. And I learned that in management yourself. I was lucky to get the right managers at the right time. You know, Colin Addison came in. I thought he was really good for me. And then Jim Smith, I love them all, you know, to be fair. They all helped me along massively. Jim was the biggest character. You met him yourself, but he was a great fella, God rest his soul. You know, and then, you know, you move on to Morris Evans, who was really quiet, but very intellectual in many ways with football. Then you go to Liverpool, Kenny Dalglish, et cetera, Jack Charlton. I absolutely adore Jack Charlton. And if you met him, you couldn't have but adore the man.
Yeah. But we'll get on to the island in a minute. But I just wondered, I was just looking at you playing for Newport and then Oxford United coming up through the divisions. You must have encountered some sort of industrial defenders sort of dealing with you at the time. Is anyone who sticks in your mind? Because you're a very, you know, a very little chap, aren't you?
Well, I could hold my own, you know, I was a bit feisty. You know,
I'm not doubting you can hold your own. I'm not picking a fight here, John. But I'm just, there were some big units charged with dealing with you.
No, you're spot on, Adrian, you know. And none other than the lads I played with, Briggs and Shotton at Oxford. They were fearful. I played against them myself. And Noel Bars, there was Noel Bar with them, you know. And you know, some of the, when I look back at some of the tells, oh, you could. Yeah, you know, you grimace. But I think they were probably the hardest pairing in the Premiership. But in them days, it was what it was, you know. The referees let it go, and they always had a free hit on you. You know, like Bulcombe early on in the game, they always pinpoint you, they hit you round about the back, you know, your Achilles or whatever, try to take it out. And the referee would say, basically, you know, do that again or I'll book you. It's sending off offence now. And the only way we could protect ourselves is wait for a long ball in the air, and then you sharpen your elbows up and you give them one in the nose or the mouth. And
in the nicest possible way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just the way it was. And then, yeah, you know, you just say, kick me again, and you get another one of them. But the referees let it go until a certain time. You know, if you had a couple of hits, you'd get a yellow card. But oh, you know, it just makes you tougher. You know, you can't succumb to bullying. And I was brought up in a place like in Liverpool called Garston, where it went on a lot in them days. And my dad ensured that, you know, never be bullied. And I say that to kids now because it still goes on. No, and I'm not make sure that, you know, let people know. But in our days, as you know, going on the football, there's a lot of bullying going on. But it was given, you know, you give it and took it.
And what was the culture shock like when you got to Liverpool then? I know there wasn't as big a gap between the top division and everywhere else then, but you were suddenly with a galaxy of stars there.
Yeah, well, for me, it was quite difficult walking to a dressing room with Rushy. I knew some of the lads, obviously, from Republic of Ireland and Alan Mountain, and played against them, and I talked to Bruce Robler and everything. And when you walk in the dressing room, like me idols, all of a sudden I'm a little bit, you know, wary and unsure of myself. I'm quite a cocky person. And I knew I had to, like, you know, let myself. But there's a lot of, you know, pee taking, you know, in the dressing room in them days, you know, they take the mickey out of you big time. So you have to make sure you can stand up and be counted in the Liverpool dressing room. But they're all great lads, you know, got on with them famously.
And what was your favourite sort of winning moment with Liverpool?
The most important, you know, I always say this when I'm talking at Liverpool or whatever, but sometimes you don't need a medal or a cup, you know, or a golden boot to prove anything. My biggest game of my life was the replay of Hillsborough. After what we've gone through and, you know, 96 at the time, 97 now, and we all went to 10, 12 funerals. I can't emphasise how big that game was, the replay. The thought of losing that after we'd lost the fans and the families, we were under enormous pressure. In the pit of my stomach, I've never felt that in the whole of my life before that game. And it was the most important game of my life. Going to Wembley against Everton, I could handle getting beat by Everton and final. But because the semi-final represented what happened at Hillsborough, that was the most important game in my life. And we won 3-1 and I scored 2. The relief after that game, I can't put into words. So I always say that game. We went on to win the FA Cup for the people that mattered, which was massive as well. Mm. The semi-finals was always the biggest game of my life. That's including any game, you know, the quarter-finals of the FA Cup, because life's more valuable than football.
Right, so I really love your story, because it didn't come all at once when you were young. You slowly worked your way up, having success along the way with the Welsh Cup at Newport and then winning the divisions with Oxford and then Liverpool. And then, you know, then you have this magical journey with Big Jack and the Republic of Ireland. You know, that, I mean, what a joy that must have been.
You can't put down to it. You know, I'm blessed in life in many ways to play for Liverpool, who I love, and to play for the Republic of Ireland. That's 10 years you could ever have under Jack, and the lads, the squad of players that I played with and got to know, and the people that I met in Ireland and I still go over to meet them, except, you know, just so lucky, you know, to be involved in that, you know. In 88, when we beat England, you know, on the big stage, Euros, you know, the World Cup 90, quarterfinals, last 16 in 94. You know, it was just ridiculous. Lads in the squad Adrian would actually go there when you were injured. He wanted to just come over there for the crack. Yeah, there was a bit of a drinking culture in football, as you know, in them days. And Jack let us off the leash a few times. On a Sunday before the Wednesday game, and, you know, after the games on a Wednesday, we'd go out and have the crack and all that. And the team camaraderie in the team was amazing. You know, and we all stuck together. And the fact that, you know, some people were calling us, you know, mercenaries coming from England and playing for Ireland, not knowing that our families, you know, in the past had to leave Ireland to survive, You know, otherwise we'd have been born in that. You don't know that part of the story. It was just a great ride with the Republic.
Let's just going back to your goal against Everton. We've actually got the audio of that. I just wanted to play you. I'm sure you've heard it before, but since it's such a precious memory for you, let's just have a listen to that.
This is Nicol looking for McMahon. Good through ball. He got away from Ratcliffe. Oh, and John Aldridge in a great position. And Liverpool have scored in their first attack. And John Aldridge, the man who missed a penalty here last season in the cup final, didn't take long to make up for it. The ball played through was for McMahon, and it caught Everton. Ratcliffe was outmanoeuvred there. The ball into Aldridge was superb, and his finish was clinical.
So, you know, I knew that. I know you said the semi-final was the one that mattered to you against Forest, the replay after Hillsborough, but that, I mean, you know, against Everton as well, you know, that must have been some day at Wembley.
It was, you know. There's a mad story behind that. The year before when we... In 1988, when we lost to Wimbledon, I obviously missed that. Well, I didn't miss the penalty. It was the best save I've ever seen from Bess. Yeah. Bess made a great save. And obviously that was my last touch of the game. I got substituted afterwards. Excuse me. There's something going on in here. I'll just go up the paper. That was my last touch of the game. And rolled the dice forward a year later, 1989 Cup Final. Everton had kickoff. My touch was in more or less in the same place, and it went where the penalty should have gone, past the great Neville Southall in the top corner. That's really weird, you know. That's really odd. It meant a lot for me. It would have been nicer if, you know, Everton wouldn't have equalised in the 91st minute and I'd have got the winning goal, but Rushy had to come on and, you know, and do the business, and we obviously won it. You know, and the FA, let's not forget, the FA Cup was, it's all been huge years ago. Nowadays, it's not looked upon as it was in them days, but it was a fantastic cup to win, as you know.
Yeah. I wouldn't know, would I? Because I haven't won it. And I was only one when my team did win it. But anyway, no, I know what you're getting at. I mean, if you'd, you know, you'd been born 30 years later, you were a kid from Garston with a gift for football now. You know, how different would it have been? Now, obviously, to take the money out of it, if you made it, obviously be a much wealthier man, but would it have been as much fun? Would it have, what do you think?
No, it wouldn't have been as much fun. You know, you're looking at different cultures together in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. There's a drinking culture and a comical, funny humour, you know, in the dressing room in them days. But now, the difference being, you go into the pitches now, you know, you couldn't get a carpet any better. It's just unbelievable. The pitch is absolutely fantastic, you know. And then you've got centre-halves, as you were talking about before and alluding to, who can't kick you. They can't come anywhere near now.
And you're not allowed to elbow them either, to be fair, John, either. So that bit of joy is gone from the game.
Yeah, but the self of that. But, you know, technically, it's a lot better. You know, it's different. It's not as exciting as it used to be because, you know, there was long boards, there was all sorts happening, there was muddy pitches. You go to the baseball ground and it was just a different game of football. But it has evolved. And it's more or less like quite nice to watch them passing back and passing forward and going back and all this. But it's not as exciting as it used to be, and you know that as well.
John in Dorset says, I hated him as a player because I'm a United fan, but he wants to know if you've done a book. He wants to hear more of this life story. You must have done a book, haven't you, John?
Yeah, I done one some time ago, man, 25 years ago, so I don't know how to go.
If you want to do another one, then I'll happily write it with you, John, because it sounds
We've come across each other a couple of times.
Yes,
and West Brom, when I think Liverpool won 4-5-0 that time, but we'll move on from that one.
Okay, we'll move on from that, and I'll offer my services for a very competitive amount. So if you've got one winning moment from your career, what would it be? What one moment which will keep you warm on a cold night when you think about it?
That's, you know what, I've been so lucky. I've been so, so lucky to in my career. And it's really, really tough. I think, going away from the Hillsborough game, I think it would be my very first goal for Liverpool. It was my full debut against Southampton. Peter Shilton was in goal and I scored the winner with 20 minutes to go, you know, and I always remember, I did Danny Road and I was celebrated like a nutter and I'm running back towards the centre circle. And I looked where Bruce is in goal and all the cops singing my name.
Oof,
and I looked back at the top of the crossbar where just behind me and my mates used to stand every single home game in the cop end.
I've got goose flesh. I've got bumps coming up all over me.
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of thing. Cause I remember. They were there watching me score down the road and what we were all used to talk about every game. So that was like a moment, like the birth of your first child type of thing, you know.
John, let's do that book. Lovely to have you on. John Aldridge in our winner's enclosure.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the country's military to keep fighting with full force in Lebanon and Gaza in response to the ceasefire proposal put forward by 12 international allies. Mr. Netanyahu's office said this is an American-French proposal to which the Prime Minister did not even respond. Frank Gardner is the BBC's security correspondent.
Both sides have put themselves into a difficult position. Hezbollah has lost a lot of its fighters in the last few days. They are weakened. They have said we will only stop when there's a ceasefire in Gaza. 11 months of negotiations haven't produced that ceasefire, so it's hard to see that being achieved in 21 days, even if everyone agreed to stop for 21 days. So I'm fairly pessimistic right now.
The current managing director of Harrods has issued a statement accusing his former boss, Mohammed Al-Fayed, of presiding over a toxic culture of secrecy, intimidation, fear of repercussion and sexual misconduct. Mr. Ward says he wants to convey his personal horror at recent sexual allegations against the billionaire. One woman has told the BBC she was attacked when she was 16 after being made to have intrusive medical examinations arranged for her with Dr. Anne Coxon, who hasn't replied to the BBC's request for comment.
When I first started working for Mohammed Al-Fayed, he soon started asking me inappropriate questions, like, did I have a boyfriend? Had I been sexually active? Well, I was only 16 years old and I was a virgin, and he soon discovered that.
The Justice for Harrods Survivors Group has filed a complaint to the General Medical Council about the conduct of Dr. Anne Coxon. The COVID inquiry has been hearing from a former national clinical advisor at NHS England who visited around 40 intensive care units during the pandemic. Breaking down in tears, Professor Kevin Fong said the scale of death was very difficult to capture in the figures and said nurses told him they had patients raining from the sky. He said that despite best efforts, patients did not receive the standard of care that would be expected in a non-COVID period. New figures suggest the average cost of children's birthday parties now costs about £524. Parents